welcome to Seize the GM. I'm your host, Zended.
I am your co-host, Jules.
And I'm Garda Moje.
Have you ever had a great idea for a campaign? Do you have a group of friends who want to play an RPG, but you have no one to run it?
Do you want to see what the world is like behind the GM screen instead of in front of it? Well, we're here to help you do just that.
Each week, the three of us will be discussing various GMing topics, terminology, maps, atmosphere, world building, you name it. So sit back and relax.
Let us help you
improve your art of GMing.
One show at a time.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Seize the GM.
And not just any old episode, we actually have a special episode for you this evening, or morning, or whenever you happen to be listening in.
Right, because, you know, time dilation and all that other fun. Time travel! Time travel!
See how I did that?
I know, I love it. Okay!
We've got two guests with us today. Yeah, so we have two guests with us today. Ed and Sophia, and they worked on a book that is about to come out from Evil Hat and actually will have a Kickstarter that you can go contribute to post-haste.
Because you should.
And we'll talk about why in the interview. And that book is Fate of Cthulhu. And yes, it is taking a look at the Cthulhu mythos through the lens of fate. And honestly, it's one of the most fun books I have read in a while. And I'm looking forward to talking about it with two of the people involved in creating and writing and bringing it to you. So, Ed and Sophia, if you would introduce yourselves, we'd love to hear you.
Sure. Hi there. I am Ed Turner. I'm a guy who makes games sometimes.
Only sometimes.
I'm also really good at self-introductions. Which you might not have been able to tell.
Yes, I have no hope of being as smooth as Ed. But I'm Sophie Lagacé. You'll probably guess from my accent that I was not born in the U.S. I'm French-Canadian. And I write for Evil Hat and other publishers. But in this case, I was primarily there. Well, I had several hats, so to speak. I started
many hats at the Evil Hats?
Yes. Also my stupid hat, which is my favorite hat. So I was first brought aboard while Sean Nittner, the director of projects, was piloting this one. And I was asked to do quality control, basically check as the development team was coming up with ideas, whether that fit with the Fate book, our Fate line, and whether that made sense. I was the reality checker in the fantasy book. Then we shuffled projects, and Sean asked me to take over project management. And somewhere during the process, our line developer, longtime line developer, Leonard Balsera, decided to move on to new adventures, very amicably, but his plate was super full. So I was asked to take over as the Fate line developer. So that's my many hats.
Nice.
First, for anyone who doesn't know, Fate is a fantastic game from Evil Hat. It's the most recent edition, I think, was about 15 years in and kind of broke a whole lot of fundraising goals the last time it was asked for a little bit of help. And it's a wonderful modern game that lets you work through the telling of stories and gaming with active and engaged protagonists in kind of what I think is one of the better balanced narrative and crunchy systems out there, with a lot of freedom to both players and GMs. And so from that standpoint, the first question I have is, Fate of Cthulhu kind of takes a unique approach to the Lovecraft mythos in that, you know, fate heroes are often active and proactive and doing things, which is a little different than the usual setup for a Cthulhu game. I think it's described in the book as more aliens and Terminator, less Shadow over Innsmouth. What inspired you to kind of take that more action and proactive oriented setting?
Well, I think I'll feel that one because I was there at the beginning and Ed came in during the process. And that was a brainchild of Fred Hicks, the company guru, the foremost hat, head under the hat, and his partner at the time, Chris. And we had some discussions on what their vision was. Oh, Chris Enrahan, I'm sorry. We have many Chris's in our lives. So we talked about their vision. Part of it was the challenge of doing something like that because the common accepted wisdom about fate is that it just does those pulpy, as you said, proactive, very powerful characters. And this is the other end of the spectrum normally, right? You imagine your investigators slowly slipping, losing their grasp on reality and possibly being eaten for dinner by some terrible creature. And it's the kind of game where you expect it's not going to be unusual to lose a few characters along the way, player characters. So that was, I think that challenge spoke to Fred and Chris. And just the idea of what if we did it as Skynet, the Elder Gods are Skynet. After all, it's another bit of long-accepted wisdom that the Elder God technology is what we perceive as magic because it's so far advanced. So that was the other ingredient in there. What if Skynet was so much more advanced than we can picture and things were coming for us in a very near future, and we had just this hair's breadth to avoid them.
Well, I think that's the other fun part here is you've got a game, a book that assumes that someone is coming back from the future to stop an apocalypse. There's some knowledge that something's going wrong. And the idea of time travel plus Cthulhu, well, a lot of geeks out there are now just kind of steepling their fingers and going, wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, that was one thing that I noticed was like really early when I started reading, I'm like, wait a second, everybody's a time traveler just about? Oh.
That's kind of up to you and your players.
Yeah.
You could play it straight as all characters from the present. It would be more difficult a little bit to conceptualize. You could certainly run it with only one or a few characters from the future. Your John Connor, you know.
And it's useful to have at least one character from the future.
Yes.
Because one of the things that I think really defines the game is that you know what the future is, and you can see it change as you do things in the present.
Yeah,
you can forcibly bear witness to the apocalypse growing better or worse if you don't do very well to try and prevent it.
Yeah.
You could kludge it so you have another way of having access to that information. A message was sent from the future, for example, because there is a stick with the carrot. And a carrot with a stick. If you are a character coming from the future, you have traveled back, so you have had to use some of that Elder or God technology, and therefore you have started on the path of corruption. You're starting to turn into a monster. And those who do have access to essentially super stunts, but they're starting to get a little uglier and a little more twisted.
Well, I think that's a great kind of segue to talk about the corruption mechanic and how the kind of extra system for that old one tech worked in there. You made a very specific choice in this about focusing on corruption instead of some of the old ways of looking at madness. I was just hoping you could tell us a little bit about that choice, and then we'll kind of talk about corruption as a tool for the players in their character.
I think it's very, very hard to do you are going mad stories in ways that are not very, very problematic.
Yeah.
To say it as nicely as possible, that requires a whole heck of a lot of sensitivity and wouldn't necessarily make a lot of room to be fun while still respecting actual problems that actual people actually have. As opposed to, you are growing tentacles out of your back now, which isn't an actual problem actual people have, and you can go a little more entertainingly gonzo with it.
Yeah, it definitely, that corruption always, it felt like it was more pulpy than the dirty, gritty insanity that Lovecraft liked to use. But his versions even of insanity were not the same as everybody else has been using. His were just the dude faints or is a gibbering idiot. I mean, those were pretty much what he had.
It was definitely something we tackled front and center when we started just establishing the basic plan of what this game could look like. Because of the factors that Ed and you were just citing. And that's probably the most important thing I did in my quality control tenure was to say, yes, I don't, I can't work on a project that will have madness as its bugbear. Ha ha.
Yeah.
And everybody had the same reaction, right? It was self-evident to our team that it wouldn't be fun to essentially play act very real mental problems that people maybe us or some of our family or of our friends may be suffering from, but the super stunts, the idea, I think, was largely borrowed or inspired from Atomic Robo, which is another really great game, by the way. I wasn't on it, so I can say that. And PK and Ed, PK Sullivan and Ed here were the ones who made it work, made the corruption work and the corrupted stunts.
I'm familiar with some of Atomic Robo and Clevenger's work and the use of corruption as that trade-off, because they are super stunts, your ability to do more, but it brings you closer to that edge, that precipice of losing yourself to whichever form of corruption you're dealing with, because that's part of the fun here, is that you've got five different timelines. Five different potential old apocalyptic old ones rising. And so it gives players a lot of flexibility in how to define that.
And if we hit some of the stretch goals for the Kickstarter, we will have further apocalypses. That's the plural, right? Apocalypses?
Apocalypse.
It's one of those words that doesn't pluralize easily.
Yeah,
you don't
you usually only get the one, yeah.
Multiple apocalypse.
Event.
Apocalypse events. There you go. See, that's how we do it now.
And so there's some good ones in store. I hope we hit as many as possible because, of course, there's some more of the great old ones and Lovecraftian mythos. But if things go really wild, we have some of the further stretch goals for other kinds of apocalypses. And I think, or even uses of time travel in ways that are action-oriented, but perhaps less horror-oriented. And the further we go.
Let me mark off a few of these questions I had further down my list because you just answered them. Because these timeline setting and the way those were built made me think of other science fiction and other kinds of games besides just how it was used here. And so I'm excited and will probably be contributing because I want to see these other uses. But I'd like to know how the kind of tracking system for these timelines either came about or what you think is the most fun aspect of tracking that with players.
Ed, do you want to take that? Since you worked,
how the timelines sort of came about is a little bit before my time. When I came in, I think that was just at the point when Leonard was sort of finishing up the first Cthulhu timeline. I don't know necessarily what the genesis of the plan for it all was, but I'm definitely willing to talk about what I think is the most fun aspect.
Let's share it for people who don't know how it works yet and how's it work and what's the fun part. How do you want to see that used or think it can be used?
All right. I'm so on board with that. So basically your timeline comes with a great big narrative story of how the apocalypse went down and how most of the people that there are died horribly or were corrupted into servants of some eldritch abomination. And then you get five events that are part of the timeline that are things that happened in the past that led to the apocalypse in some way or another. And they aren't, it's not one for one. It's you can tackle them in whatever order you want. It's just that these are kind of the pre-built adventures that are ready for you as the GM to come in and take this this seed idea and flesh it out a little bit and throw it at your players and watch them suffer.
I like this idea of suffering.
That's making that's what we're them here for. Lots of pain, lots of corruption. Some tears, and then eventually the last one, because there is a final one, which is the rise of the great old one, which is now is like the final capstone event, is you get to play out the world ends if you didn't do a very good job, or maybe doesn't if you got very lucky and very clever. And what is, I think, the most clever aspect of this, what I really love, is the interaction between the timeline track and the catalysts that each event has. Each event has four catalysts. There's a person, a place, a thing, and a foe that are just, you know, these are four elements kind of codified that make this event what it is. And some of them are, you know, bad, and some of them are neutral, and some of them could potentially be beneficial for you. And that's sort of represented on the little timeline sheet you get as, do you have a fate die plus, a fate die blank, a fate die minus next to each of these catalysts. And the other thing that you get on your timeline sheet, which is, you know, the character sheet for the timeline, is the timeline tracker, which is over the course of this adventure, over the course of this scenario, the GM takes note of what happens. And when things happen that are very, very good for the heroes trying to save the world, they put a little check on one side of this tracker. And when things happen that are very, very good for the very, very malevolent entities beneath, they put a check on the other side of the tracker. And as those add up, you get four of them, you earn a ripple, which is a change to another event on the timeline. And ideally, you'll get, you know, a couple of these on either side, so that once that scenario wraps up, after all is said and done, after the fires are put out, the GM takes these little ripples that they have gathered, little pluses and minuses, and they get fed into the other events on this timeline, so that what the players are anticipating to be, you know, a moderately bad location, but not terrible, because they have done poorly previously, or because the great old one has taken advantage previously, becomes a little more evil, a little harder to deal with. Contrariwise, if the players have done very well, they have succeeded at their task, they have saved the day somehow, then what they thought was going to be a real oppressive enemy at their next location, you know what? Maybe they're not as powerful as they used to be. Maybe they're just a neutral abomination, terrifying but not actively trying to eat you when you get within their sight. It's a way in which...
Wait. An abomination always wants to eat you when you come within sight.
Okay, it definitely wants to eat you, but it's not going to chase you very far. It's a lazy abomination.
It's a lazy abomination.
It'll let you lose sleep as long as you've got corners in your room until you finally run to ground.
Or it has an agenda. It's doing something else.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's got its own business. You know, if you don't get in its way, you'll be fine, probably, maybe.
And remember, children, the abominations are more afraid of you than you are of them.
That's
we promise. Really?
True. I was going to say, that's definitely not true. Yeah.
That is as true as my GM face lets it be.
Yes.
But the point I'm getting at is that you have this timeline of events that, like, the players, at least the time travelers, they know kind of what happened in history, but as they work on one event, everything else changes based on what they have done. You know, like, from a GM side, very easy to monitor and track and play around with way. And from the player side, in a way that they can kind of anticipate maybe things are getting better, but they still have room to be surprised by history changing under their feet. Which is something that really is beautiful, I think, in the way it sort of combines time travel shenanigans, the history isn't quite what you expect of it, and a lovely Lovecraftian state of just not really knowing entirely what's going on, because you can never know entirely what's going on.
Well, yeah, and that's where some of those GM, like the GM's like notes on those are great, because they'll be like, oh, there's this thing in the timeline, but then you read the GM stuff, and it's like, oh yeah, but that's what you just read. Yeah, that's not really what's going on. This is what's really going on.
The quote that I have written down from the book is, because the fun of the timeline is changing the timeline.
Exactly.
But we're also talking about, you've had some playtest and some feedback. I'm curious as to what feedback that you saw incorporated into the book from playtesters is something that sticks with you as really helpful and a really good piece of playtesting. For anybody out there who thinks playtesters don't matter, I want to get the designers here to say something.
Well, if the playtest doesn't matter and the playtesters don't matter, then the playtest is unnecessary. Why are you doing it, right? And at Evil Hat, this phase is taken very, very seriously. But there's different playtests for different purposes. So we started with an internal playtest where the famous multiple Sophies come from, where my character came back in time by a day to prevent a catastrophe. I think it was a nuclear meltdown, and that didn't work. And so I came back again. So we had multiple Sophies. And that's yeah. But that was the kind of playtest you do to just check if your building blocks even snap together when you play with your Legos. And then later on, you have to release it in the wild. You have to release it to third parties that will not have any of the developers at their table. You can't hold their hand or tell them what your intention was. You have a playtest document you prepared with just what you need to play, not all the embellishments, not all the timelines and so forth, but enough that they can play on their own. And that was our alpha playtest. Usually, it's very frequent that we'll go through several rounds of playtests. Some games have taken more than others. So this was a game that was in a new courtyard, right? It was a flavor of Fate that we had not tried extensively at the time. Although in parallel, we had the development of the Fate Horror Toolkit, on which Ed was also a writer. But the two projects didn't really cross over until we brought Ed on board with his having just finished that work. And then that I think that repollinated. Our alpha playtest was an open playtest. We had tremendous response. People wanted to participate to play tests. So it was one of those impressive and difficult selection process because we have a professional survey designer and Twila Campbell, Dr. Campbell, and she prepares us a questionnaire to get the proper playtesters because we want people who have a breadth of perspective, and she prepares another questionnaire which is to get their feedback on the document on the playtest book as they experienced it. And the alpha playtest was, as it should be, was rough on morale, and that's absolutely normal. But it's really hard for the creative team to get that feedback. So when I did the compilation and the timeline use was one in particular that clearly needed some work and some polish. We had a slightly different way of pushing the ripples forward. And the comment that kept coming back was that this version gave the players the impression that it all came down to the last die roll on that timeline at the last event to see if they were successful or not. So they felt although they were having an impact, it wasn't immediately felt. It was it's just a handful of dice, and so the team worked really hard to redesign that aspect. I believe that's when Ed was brought on board, because Lenny Balsera came in to help with the packaging, I think, of the alpha playtest. And in between the alpha and the beta, people worked really hard. That was the other thing, is we had a certain publishing timeline. We wanted to be able to release this in 2019. And you have to count the time to do the layout, have the art, and so forth. So we had to push forward, so that means having more people to work, but it can't be just anyone. It has to be people who work well together and understand the system. So we had a fantastic team, and they took that playtest feedback to heart. And I see in the notes that we received on the beta playtest, we had a number of people who had participated in the first version. And generally, they felt that their feedback had changed things, had been addressed, or at least had been taken into consideration.
That's great to hear. Also, I'll point out that the game and the five timelines are all set around a 2020 event, so publishing in 2019 puts it right there for the players to have present or near future adventures.
Yeah. So it doesn't change too much of the world that they already know.
Right. It's that five-minute into the future premise.
Now, I mentioned already we've got five different timelines and basically adventure tracks in the book. I'd like to know what your favorites are, just to give some of our listeners and the people who may tune in an idea of what excited you from the story aspect, not just the really neat, fiddly way of building timelines.
Ooh. Well, as one of my tasks specific to timelines is I made most of the monsters and bad guys and horrible creepy crawlies within them. Oh. So that's kind of what draws my heart in. And also, now I reach a point where I'm going to have to say one of these names out loud, and that's never a good plan.
It never is.
I really like Nyarlathotep. Nyarlathotep. I think that there's a lot of fun monsters in there that I would love to just pick up and throw at a player and say, you know, deal with this thing now.
Yeah.
This guy walks through walls. Enjoy. And that is the one that holds the greatest place in my heart for that reason, because it's got the scariest beasties, in my opinion.
I have to agree with that. And it's to go with it, it's got some really lovely, horribly lovely illustrations of those monsters. The art is not complete, but what we do have, I love those monsters.
Oh, what we have is awful and wonderful, and I want to see it all.
These monsters are largely drawn by Sarah Dillinger, who is also a professional illustrator for like biology specimens and so forth, natural history. So it's her thing is making the monsters look like real beasties you could dissect on the table, or that could dissect you in this case. And we also have a lot of art, including some of these monsters by Kurt Komoda, who's a veteran. And he, too, has a wonderful way of bringing the monstrous alive.
What we've gotten to see in kind of the review is it walks that perfect balance between the horror and the dread, and like we talked about early on, kind of the dynamic, active, I think someone described it as punch Cthulhu in the face kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know if it's perfect, but we do know that in Fate you can throw a lot at the player characters, and they can take it and keep going. So we have to have some really good scary monsters.
Now, I will admit a fondness for the King in Yellow, and the arrival of the King in Yellow track in their timeline is definitely my fun. But
I was going to say, yeah, that's like out of the ones I read, that was the one that was just like, yeah, I really want to run that game.
The writing is excellent. And that's one of the great assets we had on the development team. Stephen Blackmore is just such a good writer of action horror. I personally love his books, so go look for them. He's a great writer, but he has a sense of that the balance between having something that is familiar and quotidian, that something that that feels like you could be reading it in the news, and then throwing those, abysmal horrors that your brain can't conceive of, and putting them side by side, and that juxtaposition makes it gives it a special effect, I think.
Yeah. Yes.
I really can't say enough about how much I enjoyed reading the book and how much fun I think it can be. We talked about some of the potential stretch goals in the Kickstarter, additional timelines, additional ways to use this time travel. But what I want to know, as we kind of, I think, are getting a good handle on the excitement from both of you, what do you hope to see from players, or what do you hope to hear from players after they get their hands on this?
Screaming, just lots and lots of screaming, wailing, gnashing of teeth.
Ed, you'd fit right in on the regular show. You just want to keep coming back.
I think Jules needs to ask questions about the horror toolkit now, because this is...
I've got it sitting over there. I mean, in full disclosure, of all the games that I own, I have spent more money on Fate this year and last year than I have any other game system. So yeah,
right before we started recording, I may have just gone and downloaded and bought another $50 worth of Fate products.
Yeah, and it was because of me, because I've been telling him Fate is awesome. You need to start looking at it. And he's like, It's not crunchy enough. I'm like, it's fine. Trust me.
And I dove into it, and I am falling head over heels and enjoying it greatly. I have found its balance. It's joy for me.
So here's a question. So I know you said that there's going to be other mythos horrors and things like that as stretch goals. Now, without knowing any of those, if you were to have to pick one that didn't make it into the book as it sits right now, which one would it be?
Ah, well, let's go see the list, because we made a long list, and then we looked at what would work best with this. I remember that one of the challenges was if you're going to write another time travel story with it, what was going to be the equivalent of corruption? And if we couldn't find that, or if it didn't gel really, then it didn't make it to the final list. Let's see. Oh, all these wonderful monsters.
I know, there's so many.
Let's see. I'm reading my file names, and they all have names like Shub-Niggurath. And I remember that we talked about, can we do, for example, in the far out stretch goals, could we go towards something lighter, something that's not horror like Back to the Future? And that's when that question about corruption was a big issue. I remember that we talked about the fading away that Marty McFly does in the movies. That would not give the same as corruption, because you can't pair it with stunts. So that's more of a rewrite. So I don't expect that something like that would end up on the final list. And that's the other thing, is the list will the length of the list will depend on the enthusiasm or lack thereof on the Kickstarter. You know, if we don't fund very well. That said, I think we had fantastic stretch goals. That right from the beginning, there's a lot of value. You get a lot of goodies just for signing on to bring the basic book. So I'm crossing my finger that we will get this interest.
You hear that, listeners? If you're not on the Kickstarter already,
you need to go.
Go to the link in the show notes, or just go straight to your Kickstarter and donate now, because if they hit a lot of these stretch goals, we want them to come back and tell us about the ones that were the most fun to roll out. So you're going to help us with that, right, listeners?
And in addition, that means also bringing fantastic additional authors to the table. So I want to see all these people, right? We got some, I'm not going to burn it now because I want to see how the early stretch goals go. But if we go further, we have just such good pairing of authors with great old ones. Nice. The first one I can give away this because it will be you will be seeing it right from the beginning. Our first alternate timeline is Whitney Beltran, Whitney Strix Beltran, writing The Color Out of Space.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're all like that. They're just such good fits.
Yeah.
Oh, all right, people. I mean, this is.
I'm going to say it. I told my wife when I was like halfway through reading, I said, you realize I'm backing this Kickstarter. She goes, I figured already. So you got my money regardless.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
So. Yeah.
Yes, insert in the notes, in the show notes, insert the little gif of Fry, you know.
Yes, shut up and take my money. Yes.
Well, I think we've hit a lot of the questions and ideas we wanted to really talk about, and it's great hearing your excitement. What haven't we gotten to that you want people to know about Fate of Cthulhu?
I have one thing I'd like to say. That sounds so serious. There has long been a truism that fate doesn't work for horror. Mm-hmm. Like you see that, or I see that all over the place on varied and sundry message boards, and I really like to think that both with the Fate Horror Toolkit and now even more so with Fate of Cthulhu, we are really, taking this truism to task. We're really saying that no, this can be a horrifying game if you let it. It is built to be as horrifying, as terrifying as you want it to be.
And for me, it's the feeling that we're responding to a need in a lot of people. While we were developing the book, morale got low at some points due to the state of the world, reading and watching the news, and we all had the same reaction. It's just like, yes, this is the game we need. We need to be able to punch Cthulhu in the face right now.
Well, and I think it's a lot of fun, and I think it's nice for me to see sci-fi getting bled into this again. I'm a sci-fi junkie, and I don't always see enough sci-fi out there, so I'm excited about its expanded use and what you've done.
Yeah,
me too.
Especially the melding of the horror with science fiction, because there aren't that many things that actually do it and do it well. And this does both of them well. So.
Well, thank you for the kind words. I will be happy to take it back to the rest of the development team. Everybody loves to hear that they hit the mark.
Yeah.
It's one of the most exciting books I've read this year. And one of the things I'm most excited to see hit print, and I'm going to be backing the Kickstarter as well because I am excited about what else can be done with some of this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things. I love getting in and then taking things and using them for other things. I have an idea that I want to play with using Tachyon Squadron, which is another one of yours, and Macross,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and melding the two of them and then throwing bits of this into it to make horror and time. Yes. That's the game I'm going to run next, I think.
Juicy.
But yeah, that's kind of what I was, so when I'm reading all of this, it's just I see all the bits that you can pull apart and use. And this has a lot of really fun ones that you can pull apart and use.
That's something we encourage. That's why there's all these toolkits for different aspects, I guess, of the game.
I think, as we say on this show a lot, that could be a whole other show. And instead of going on for another hour, which I think all of us could do, I think we might be at a good spot of wrapping up and thanking our special guests for coming in and giving us this inside look at Fate of Cthulhu, which is live on Kickstarter right now, and Evil Hat wants to bring you the best of the great old ones from the future to today, now.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you so much. It's so exciting to hear your enthusiasm. After so much time staring at these words, it's so great to hear people get excited about it.
Yeah, and to see it take shape too in layout and art, right? It's becoming a real baby.
A real horrible, monstrous baby.
Yes.
Soon it will burst forth into the world, and all those who encounter it will succumb.
Yes. Yes, they will. If they know what's good for them. So, yeah, it was great having you guys on. So, and yeah, once this is all done, we definitely want to have you guys back to talk about how things went, if you guys are up for it.
That sounds lovely.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
And maybe some of the others will be available too.
That would be great too.
If they are, and we can take a deeper dive into some of the particular uses in one of those timelines. We've got lots of thoughts, lots of ideas, but check the show links check the links in the show notes. We've got the Kickstarter link. We've got the Evil Hat link. We've got where you can find Sophie and Ed online, and we're looking forward to a great 2019.
Indeed.
You let us know about your tales.
You can contact us or the show using Twitter, Facebook, or plain old email. Our Twitter accounts are @Zendead,
@JulesPodcaster,
and @2050GardMoje.
And the show's Twitter account is @SeizeTheGM.
You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/SeizeTheGM. Or chat with us and other RPG lovers in our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/SeizeTheGM.
You can email questions or comments to the show at admin@SeizeTheGM.com. And if you have a few bills you want to send us, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/SeizeTheGM podcast. And we thank you.
Joining us for this episode of Seize the GM. Feel free to leave a comment about this episode on our webpage, www.seizethegm.com. Let the dice fall where they may, and we'll see you all again next week.
Seize the GM is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike 4.0 international license. All copyrighted materials referenced herein are held by their respective owners. No infringement intended, and no claim of ownership is implied.
The music for the show is Dreaming Spirit, off the album Ghost Machine by the Enigma TNG. His music is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 3.0 Unported License.